NerdWallet Show this week, my first investment. I love that we took 175 episodes to get to my first investment.
I also thought you said my first investment.
That makes no sense.
No.
My name is Christia. With me as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It's going excellent.
If you're new to this podcast, you should know that a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for bleeping us. Apparently, Tamron's poodle hates the bleeped show. She says, I was listening to an old show where you were asking if anyone listens to the beeped version. I usually don't, but I clicked on that one by mistake. My poodle did not approve. For every bleep, she just sat completely still and glared at me.
Okay, that's a poodle with style.
Winner of the week this week is Brendan. He spent 3 years getting rid of debt. He says, I'm currently debt free.
Now you see, it's you. You're making THs into THRs. First.
I'm Afrikaansing. This is the second episode that we're recording today. So
back to back.
Yeah. Okay, let's try that again. Brendan is debt free after 3 years, he says, of a hell ride trying to free up all my debt. I don't know. Like, it's like you guys set me up to fail with that one. He says, I'm now at a point in my life where my partner and I have a combined amount of 21,000 rand a month to invest.
Yo.
I'm thinking about an emergency fund before investing, as well as going the ETF route in a tax-free account. Do you think that this is enough money to fuel my investing engine?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So remember, your emergency fund is 3 to 6 months of your combined expenses.
Yeah. Less savings and tax.
Yeah. So just expenses as in how do you get through the month. And then tax-free account, then RA, then discretionary investments. And with 21,000 rand a month, you guys should be there fairly quickly.
Yeah. So depending on the expenses, the emergency fund will take a bit of time, and you can probably do some tax-free and emergency at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah, because I mean, 21 a month is 360 a year. Assuming it's two tax-free accounts, it's only 660. That leaves 294,000
more to play with.
So you could perhaps do your tax-free at simultaneously build, you know, what for the rest of this tax year, because you can smash that tax-free in a couple of months between now and the end of the tax year.
Yeah. And if they have a credit card, you know, 21,000 rand a month, like if you have an emergency, 21,000 rand a month, you can probably pay off in that 55-day period, providing your emergency is not more than that in a month.
Yeah.
Okay. What a cool thing.
Congrats on it. And 3 years is a long time, and it was painful, but boom, here you are.
Yeah. 21K a month.
Yeah.
Lekker. That was the best thing for me about paying off my debt, is that first month where I didn't have any payments going off, and I was like,
"You are a baller.
I am rolling in money." Yeah. It was so awesome.
And you're rolling, and it's not debt money. You're like, you've got randellas
it's
in your
real
hand.
Money.
It's
I was like, what am I going to do with all this money? It was awesome.
Yeah.
So Cabello needs some help getting started. So I thought maybe we could dedicate the show to everybody who is keen on taking that plunge for the first time, because I know it's the scariest investment. It's always the first one. Cabello says, I'm able to save 10,000 rand a month, but I have no clue where to invest. I'm seeking any tips to help me. So first of all, just to recap what we always say, you need a very strong foundation before you make your first investment. That strong foundation starts with dread and disability cover to cover you in case you get injured or ill. Emergency fund to cover your expenses for 3 to 6 months in case you lose your job. And then short-term insurance is an optional extra, just if you want to kind of protect your asset building capacity from disasters.
Yeah, I mean, short-term insurance until you can self-insure. And you know, initially you can self-insure your cell phone, maybe. Actually, that's a bad example. But, you know, and you slowly take it up. But for most people, your contents of your home, your car, your fancy laptops, if they're not work-provided, etc., your fancy phones, if they're not work-provided, unless you've got a good emergency fund, you need to insure those.
Yeah. So you can probably, when you set up your dread and disability cover, that's an insurance policy anyway. You can use that opportunity to also do short-term insurance. Start with the big things that allow you to earn an income on your short-term insurance. So, you know, whatever it is that allows you to make money, make sure that stuff is protected. And then your emergency fund. But then from there, Cabello, if you've got that stuff sorted out, then you need a tax-free account. Let's talk about that.
So tax-free account, you can open it with a myriad of service providers. You want to find one that gives you a full DIY solution. You want low fees.
What do you mean by that?
By DIY, that you can pick and choose your ETFs that you put in it, because some of the providers don't allow you to. FNB, they put half into their top 40 and half into their mid-cap ETFs, and you got no selection on that. Some put you into cash. Those are terrible. So shop around, find yourself a tax-free provider. There are plenties that lets you nominate the ETFs you want that have low transaction fee and admin fee. I don't mind an admin fee. For example, the Standard Bank internet banking tax-free account charges 10 rand a month. It doesn't, was it every 2 months? Whatever. It doesn't stress me. What stresses me is the 2% a year, because in year one, 2% is $60. But in year 25, 2% is hundreds of thousands of ZAR. So low cost, nice and simple, your own DIY. If you want to, and next step back a moment, this is if you want to be a DIY investor, and maybe this is a step too far for you, in which case you just want someone to whom you can hand over the money and they will manage it on your behalf, and that will cost you more. And that's folks like ETFSA, that's Outvest, and probably others. They will charge you more, a percent and a half, but they will do everything for you. So you just hit the debit and off it goes. And, you know, because for some folks, you know, you log on to these really simple processes and they're still just not that simple or that easy or unscary or whatever. Importantly, if you don't get into the best, if you open a tax-free account now and at some point in the future you want to change because you thought you would do DIY and you don't, or you bought a bad one and you want to get a good one, or you're doing non-DIY and you want, you can move them. You can move it. So you're not locked there for life.
You can also have more than one.
Yeah, but your limit remains 33,000 per year, tax year, so March to February.
Okay, explain why it's a bad idea to be in cash.
Because cash just gives you a dodgy return. You know, it's barely beating inflation. Stock markets over the long term beat cash. A tax-free account in most scenarios, and I'm assuming in this scenario, is a long-term investment. So cash is nice and secure in that it'll give you, let's say, 8% a year, guaranteed. Click along. You're going to do better in a market over the long term. Other point is that interest, the first 23,000 of interest is tax-free for an individual under the age of 65. And if you're earning 8%, you need to therefore have a quarter of a million rand before earning 8% before you have a tax liability.
Yeah, in other words, you already, that money, cash money is already interest-free for most of us.
And then it's taxed at your marginal rate, and your marginal rate might be 15%, in which case, what's the worry? Yeah.
Okay, so let's bring this down all the way, because this is now somebody's first investment. Mm-hmm. Okay, when I made my first investment, what I understood on the day that I made, no, what I struggled to understand leading up to my first investment is, how do I invest? Like, what platform do I use? Do I use my bank? Do I use, how do I know that I can, that the person is trustworthy? Where did my money go for 5 days? Let's talk about all that stuff.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to open, and this is assuming you're doing a DIY of sorts. You're going to open the account.
The account time is referring to is a, it's called a brokerage account. And for the longest time, I thought a broker was a person. The way to understand that, a brokerage account is kind of like Takealot for shares. Like it's like an online forum platform where you can go and buy different shares. And typically, you would open a brokerage account that has a tax-free component and a component that's not tax-free. So you have to be very sure your first investment goes to the tax-free side.
Yes. So you shop around, you open up your account, check what your bank offers.
How do you find one? How do you find a broker?
Well, so you could go to the jc.co.za website. And they've got a list of brokers there. That list is giant. So let's rattle off some names. The ABSA product tax-free product isn't bad as long as you're doing big amounts, as long as you do the whole 33,000 at one shot in the 1st of March. Otherwise, it's not quite the cheapest. The Standard Bank, if you bank with Standard Bank and you sit with an internet banking, 10 rand a month, nice and easy. You open it up, you're off to the races. They've already got
what's
your
fee. What's the brokerage on there?
0.25, no minimums. Easy Equities, 0.25, no admin, no minimums. Who are the other banks? Nedbank, I've never been able to work out what their offering is. FNB force you into buying those two particular ETFs. Nothing wrong with them, but I want more flexibility, and we'll come to a moment what we think you should perhaps be looking at, and it's not those two. The others, Capitec doesn't offer, the Investex and the like are high-cost products. Outvest is a point at 1.5%, but it's all bells, everything included. ETFSA, I think, is 1%. I can't remember if that's including or excluding VAT, but again, that's all. They do everything for you. So you go, your first question is how dirty do you want to get your hands? If you don't, then it's an ETFSA or an Outvest. If you're happy to get your hands a little bit dirty and have some frightening moments, because there's some...
And some fun.
But they're going to be some... Do we remember the frightening ones more than the fun ones?
It's true.
There's some things you're going to have to do which are going to, like, spook you. Like, you're going to have to push a button and buy something, and, like, you push a button and, like, nothing really happens, truthfully. I mean, like, a screen comes
except,
up. And,
except your money disappears for 3 days.
And that's et cetera, et cetera. So shop around, find yourself one. Those are probably the top that I'm aware of. I mean, there may be some others. Everyone offers them, but with varying degrees of niceness. Rand Swiss has got one, but I can't remember what their fees are.
So Rand Swiss actually have an incredibly cheap product. But the thing is, they want people, because your tax-free investment, as Patrick Mackay says, is the last money you'll ever use. Mm-hmm. What Rand Swiss do is they put you in and they don't give you access like you would in so you literally fill out a form. They're like, cool, there's your money in tax-free, now go away. Like, they don't want you poking at that money all the time. But they are actually, I think, the cheapest in the market at the moment. I'm not entirely sure. But
okay, I've got a list here which I was putting together. You can go direct to the issuers such as Satrix Now, CoreShares.
Ooh, that's a good point. So the Satrix Now is actually a great little platform because there's no minimums there.
Yeah, but you can only buy Satrix product.
Yeah.
CoreShares, you can only buy. So CoreShares is brokerage of 0.1 and admin of 0.3 a year, but you can only buy their products.
So with the Satrix one, it used to be an issue that you could only buy the Satrix products, but they've got such a wonderful, diverse product range at the moment.
Sure.
That you can buy local, international ETFs and stuff. So that's like a great place for a first-time investor to start.
There's Signia that my list here says admin 0, brokerage 0, minimum brokerage none. Oh, but you can only buy Signia unit trusts. So it's not even ETFs, it's unit trusts. And they can't have, because they're not tax-free, they can't have performance fees in them, and they're probably passive product, be that as it may. Really, 0, 0 and none, hey? This is what I was doing when you were waltzing it up in travels around the world. Figure one, find one, decide what the story is, et cetera, et cetera. Then you open the account. You would have to do FICA. If you're opening it with a bank you already bank with or a platform you already have a relationship, the FICA is done. But you're going to have to do FICA, prove who you are.
But FICA now is so easy. Like on the CoreShares platform, that FICA process was just so elegant.
Some more easy than others. Some still want a lock of your grandmother's hair. Mm. Yeah.
Don't do that one then.
No.
There's like a high barrier to entry. Forget it. There's so many competitors. You can just go find one.
Yeah. And then now you're open. Now your account is open. You get an email that the process, once they've got the FICA, shouldn't take more than a day or two. And boom, boom, you are the proud recipient of a tax-free account. You've probably got a vanilla account as well. Make sure you know which is which.
So when I did my first investment, the process of opening the account and just transferring, because like a fool, I did a lump sum investment for my first one. If you are new, it actually is easier to start with smaller amounts just to get used to the process. But I did a lump sum investment. At that time, it took the JSE 5 days to process my money. So my money disappeared for 5 days, which I didn't know was going to happen. Scared the bejesus out of me. But then once that was done, I opened the account and it's like, now I have cash sitting in this account. I didn't realize that I now have to go buy stuff. So it's not the same. It's for the same as it would work on Takealot. Like you don't go to Takealot, you know, transfer money into your Takealot account and now you have whatever you want. You still need to go onto the platform, go select the products yeah. that you want.
When you transfer the money, make sure you send it to the right bank account, make sure you've got the right reference number, make sure it arrives in the right account, i.e. your tax-free account.
So this stuff that we're talking about right now, this is just like normal admin. This is the kind of normal admin that you do when you open your own bank account and stuff. It's not scary at all.
And when you send it, it's going to take some time for it to arrive. You know, money goes in a two-day sabbatical when you transfer it somewhere. Don't worry, you're earning the interest on it, etc. And then eventually one day the money will arrive. Some places will pop you an email when it does. Usually they don't. So every evening, you know, morning, whatever, go and check, see when it arrives. If it's not there in 3 days, start poking. Start saying, hey, where's my money? Start to panic. But you know, give it, but if it's not in the same bank, so if you're sending it to a third party, it's going to take 2 days. That's just how money rolls. Although I'm actually seeing transactions happen overnight now between banks. But anyway, so it's going to take some time to get there. Boom. Now your money's there. It's in. You will be earning interest. It might be a very modest interest. It will be earning some interest. Now you need to buy something with your money.
Yeah, so transferring into a tax-free account, that you're not done. You haven't even begun yet.
No. This is just early, yeah.
and so now the question is actually to get to the nuts and bolts of Cabello's question, which is, now what do I buy?
So a global diverse ETF.
So when we talk about a broad market ETF, what we mean is that this is an ETF is an investment product that invests in individual shares on your behalf.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of you going out and buying every single share in the market, this product goes out and does that on your behalf, and you only have to buy one share. So the way I like to think about it is kind of like buying a fruit salad. So if you buy a fruit salad, it's like one container containing all sorts of different fruits in different amounts. So there's always that horrible melon right at the bottom that
I'm thinking I need a better. I'm like, I want a mixed venison pie.
So like you get like all the melon at the bottom because there's melon. No one likes melon, and melon is in season. And then you also get some grapes and some strawberries
Half of a strawberry floating over in the corner.
Yeah, and don't even think about a blueberry.
No.
Anyway, so it kind of works. So an ETF works similarly. It goes into the market, it buys a whole bunch of different stuff, it packages them together, and you buy the package, and inside the package you get a whole bunch of different stuff, like a fruit salad.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about a broad market ETF, what we mean is like every single company that is available within a specific market, that ETF has a tiny bit inside, right? So when you buy a broad market world ETF, it means that they look at different markets around the world and they buy individual companies on your behalf, and you just buy that one ETF.
Mm-hmm.
Locally, the top 40 is our broad market ETF. It's the 40 companies that have the biggest impact on the movement of the market. And what I do is I have a world broad market ETF and I have a local broad market ETF, and I contribute to both of them. Which one? If you find our podcast on one ETF to rule them all, you'll find that we really like the Ashburton 1200. If you're only going to buy one investment of any kind, that is the one that we are buying for ourselves at the moment. But as you learn more about this, that can change over time.
Yeah, it's a good place to... Yeah. We can debate if it's the best ETF in the world or not, but if it's not the best, it's up there with, you know, it's up and around.
It's very good.
Yeah.
The thing is, if you have opened a Satrix Now account, you're not going to be able to buy that because... Mm-hmm. So when we say Satrix, CoreShares, Ashburton, those companies are ETF issuers. Mm-hmm. Means they make the fruit salad, basically. So you get different brands of ETFs. So if you open a Satrix Now brokerage account, you're not going to be able to buy an Ashburton product on there.
Yeah.
It's like a house brand, right? And Satrix have... Most ETF issuers now have a competitive product for a world ETF. And on Satrix, that would be the Satrix MSCI World. I think Signia have an MSCI World. Mm-hmm. CoreShares have the Global Dividend Aristocrats. So you're gonna find an equivalent. In other words, one ETF that invests in as many companies in as many regions around the world as you can find.
Yeah, and you want that nice, wide, broad, diverse bits of everything –
Yes.
Across everywhere.
And then you're going to get so excited, Cabello, and then you're going to buy all of the things. Yep. And it's just part of the process. Buy them all. You'll figure it all out.
Yeah, in about a year, you'll mail us and say, I own 23 ETFs. Yes. Now what?
So what I love about this strategy, so going into ETFs, going into a tax-free savings, is that the risk you take is immensely low. You're going into a diversified portfolio at a low cost. If you make a mistake and you, let's say, Cabello, you go out and you buy the worst ETF that has ever existed in the world, and Simon and I each have our ideas about what that would be. But let's say you go out and you buy that, and a year later you learn some more stuff about ETFs and you realize that you've made a mistake. What do? You sell it.
Yeah.
That's it. Because it's a diversified product, the risk of a single company is extremely low. So the odds that you would have lost a lot of money is not incredibly high unless there was a market crash in that region.
In which case everything crashed. So
yeah, and in which case you just wait for it to recover a little bit. So it's like a really low risk way of going in. The other way to just make this a little bit easier for yourself is to go in with small amounts of money at a time. So I know you say that you are able to save 10,000 Rand a month. Maybe make sure that you pad your emergency fund nicely so you feel nice and safe with that money sitting there. And just start with money that if you had to lose all of it, it wouldn't break your heart. So, you know, maybe that's 100 Rand, maybe it's 500 Rand, like the upper amount of what you can stomach to lose, just so that this process doesn't traumatize you. Because it is, for some reason, when we start in this, it is so scary. And that is why people would rather invest in pyramid schemes than the stock market.
Well, yeah, it's because we've been, you know, you hear all the horrors. When you hear the stories about how people got rich, it's always that they robbed a bank or got rich in property or bees or Bitcoin.
They made all their money in one thing.
Yeah. When you hear horror stories of how people went broke, it's always like, oh, they invested in the stock market.
Mm.
Now, both of those are lies, but those are the two memes that exist around the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this is how you get started. This is the first investment that you make, and this is kind of your gateway drug to the stock market is an ETF. yeah. Okay. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, except expect it to be scary at points.
Yeah, and it might be worth
reach out, you know, hit peeps on the Twitters, contact call centers if you're not sure. You know, like all these places, transactions are done online. For your first transaction, that might be overwhelming. Well, then phone the call center and say to them, please, ma'am, sir, I'd like to buy that one for this much. Please make it happen.
You know what, Cabello? Also be careful of going to a person who says that they will do it for you.
Oh, don't do that.
Because normally those people charge a lot of money to do what we just told you to do.
No, normally they disappear to the Eastern Cape.
No, I mean like an active fund. Like with Alan Gray.
I thought someone you met in the bar.
No. So don't go to like a guy with a German sedan and a suit and say, here's my money.
Hard-earned money. Please waste it.
You do it first. And then later on, you can see if maybe you want some help or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is completely within your reach to do this, and you shouldn't be scared to do it.
Yeah.
The Fat Wallet Community Forum is such an excellent place for you to be while you do this. Because as things terrify you, you go onto the forum and you say, I've just done this. Is this normal? And then people on the forum would be able to tell you, yes, it's normal, or no, it's not normal. So it's really good to have a community of people that you can reach out to ask questions, like people who've done it before you, to ask questions as you go along and to get feedback as you go along. Mm-hmm. So don't be afraid of doing that. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to judge you there, I promise you. All right. Quentin is trying to make sense of tax regarding cash versus bonds, basically. So he's looking at the New Funds Money Market ETF and he's looking at the New Funds Govy ETF. He says, should one rather invest in a low volatility ETF like the New Funds Govy instead of a money market type portfolio with similar annual returns because of the tax? Are you investing in an asset which is subject to CGT instead of income tax? So I love this question because actually these two things are taxed exactly the same way.
Yeah.
So how it works is when you earn interest on cash or when you earn, they call it coupons on bonds, but it's the same thing. It's really just interest that you're earning.
Mm-hmm.
That gets added to your income tax,
mm-hmm.
and you get taxed at your marginal tax rate. Your marginal mm-hmm. tax rate is how much you pay because of the monthly income that you earn. And so they add it on top of that, and sometimes that pushes you into a higher tax bracket, and then you pay more tax.
Notwithstanding, your first $23,000 if you're under 65 is free for interest earned.
Yes, for interest, not for tax in general.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So you need, what did we work out last week? It is about a quarter of a million rand in cash at or 8%, bonds.
Yeah. Earning you 8% before you hit it.
At cash or bonds before you hit that 23,000 rand annual tax exemption thing.
Yeah.
And then remember, like it's 23,000 rand. So let's say you've got a quarter of a million rand sitting there. You're earning 8% interest. You hit that 23,500. Now you're liable for tax. Now it's not going to be like, you know, if you have 300,000 rand sitting there, you're not going to pay like this ridiculous amount of tax and immediately be in a higher tax bracket. You now start from one. So they add like every one rand that you earn to your salary after 23,500 rand.
Yeah. So if you've got 300 instead of 250, you're going to earn about an extra 4,000 rand a year that will get added to your taxable income.
But it won't necessarily push you into a higher tax
4,000
bracket.
4,000 is not massive.
It depends on where you are in the brackets.
Yeah.
It is. I know this tax stuff, when you don't initially understand how it works, it sounds like we're talking gibberish right now, but it's worthwhile to figure out the tax brackets, because almost every investment decision that you make after your tax-free savings account is impacted by those tax brackets. So it's really, really worthwhile for you to go figure that out. But Quentin, no. So the APSA Money Market versus the New Funds Gavi, you're investing in two different asset classes there. The returns you get are calculated differently. But the tax you pay is the same. The kind of tax that you pay is the same. All right. Robin has a great question about dividends and ETFs. She says, I invested in 6 different ETFs in my tax-free account. I also mistakenly, I'm assuming she thinks this was a mistake because she says, I also mistakenly bought Woolies shares through my normal online trading account before I had heard of the tax-free savings account. The brokerage cost more than doubled the cost of the 3 shares that I bought in Woolies.
Yeah.
That was a rookie mistake, but I know better now. It's okay.
Yeah, you're smarter.
Yeah, we all do this. She says, last week I received a tiny dividend on those 3 Woolies shares.
Yo.
It was 2 rand 69 that she received.
So that's about 6 chuckles. Not bags, chuckles. Chuckle. 6 chuckle.
Hey, that's actually quite cheap for 6 chuckles.
Chuckle.
Yeah.
Not plural. Chuckles when you buy a bag. Chuckle when you buy the singular.
For 6 chuckle units. She says, I also own the CoreShares Top 50 ETFs, which holds Woolies as one of the shares. Should I not have received dividends on that?
Ooh, no.
Isn't that a great question?
Yeah.
So this is exciting because now we get to talk about how ETFs are made.
So Robin, you kind of did and you kind of didn't. So those Woolies shares are held on your behalf by CoreShares. Woolies paid a dividend to CoreShares because they hold those shares. CoreShares will now allocate at the end of the quarter those dividends to you. But it won't just be Woolies, because ShopRite paid a dividend and Standard Bank paid a dividend and Capitec paid a dividend. So there'll be a bunch of dividends that all come together.
Everybody, all of those 50 companies who have paid a dividend in that period.
Correct.
All of those are pooled by CoreShares.
Yeah.
And then popped into your account at the once a quarter.
Yeah. And then what happens, I'm checking if they're a quarterly payer. So they get all those dividends. They keep them aside. They're not going to pay to you every time they arrive, because that's just an admin
nightmare. Teeny amount.
Yeah. So they bulk them up. They pay them out quarterly, biannual, as the case may be. You earn interest on that money. So you will also accrue some interest that will come your way. And then before they pay out, they take their fees off. So you've got your dividends plus your interest, less the fees for the cost of managing that ETF, which in the case of this one's about 0.25% or so. And if it's a quarterly dividend, it'll be 0.6, blah, blah. And then you'll get it. So it'll all come in one lump sum. And I think it's 5 times a year, but if I could type faster, I could check. Sorry, not five times a year. Yep, so quarterly. So they pay every quarter. So what you will notice is that some quarters will pay bigger, some will pay smaller, because companies are typically staggered. Their year ends are typically either December or February, and a December year end is paying a dividend in about April, but a February year end is paying a dividend in about July. So they will fall into different quarters. So what you note is that your October and April quarters are bigger, your January is very small, and your July is middling.
And when you hold, which I don't think this one is, I'm actually not sure. Oh, you know who? Oh, who's OneInvest?
That is the new StanLib.
Oh, I just opened this and I was like,
So StanLib and Standard Bank have merged all of their ETFs together and labeled them as OneInvest. As I understand that process, the name change hasn't yet happened. It's still going through the process.
What I wanted to say is, if you hold a total return ETF, and the only one that I can think of right at this moment is the Satrix MSCI World one.
Satrix Raffi as well.
When you hold a total return ETF, it means that the ETF issuer, instead of paying the dividends into your account, take those dividends and they buy more units of the companies that you hold. So you get more your
unit value.
Your investment grows, but it doesn't grow in the same way as it would have grown if you had just bought more of those units. So the value of each ETF unit that you hold goes up by the dividend amount less fees. You don't see that money come into your account. Where you are very lucky, Robin, is when the CoreShares Top 50 pays out, that's literally like cash in your account. Not literally like cash in your account. It's literally cash in your account. So then you can use that money to do whatever you want with it.
See, Hag, it's interesting. So the RAFI does pay out. Well, that's a total return. It pays out a quarter of the dividend to you because that's your tax liability.
No, but they deduct tax before they pay to you.
Mm-mm.
Yes. Your tax gets paid out of your dividends. Your dividend withholding tax gets paid out of your dividends before they come to you.
So why is the RAFI paying me a small little dividend?
Why are you holding the RAFI? That's the bigger question.
I don't. My niece holds the RAFI.
All right. So Robin has a follow-up question. She says, is it okay to use my online trading account as a savings account? Because it gives me 8% interest. I've been told that that's what I need to get my investments to reach my financial freedom number. So Robin, if you cap your investments at whatever percentage you need to get your financial freedom number, you also limit the ability to, you have that amount of years to do it. You can't do it sooner than that.
Yeah, so 8% is a very low number for financial freedom, and it depends on the assumption on inflation. But the market will typically deliver more than cash, albeit with short-term risk.
Yeah, although, so what Robin is saying is I'm not getting 8% on my ETFs at the moment.
No, you're not.
So I thought it would be better to put some cash into the online account instead of investing in flatline ETFs. What do you think? I don't love this.
No, I mean, you've got your emergency fund already earning you a paltry 8%, but over the long term, equities do better. And for example, over the last 12 months, our top 40, I just had a squiz, excluding dividends, is up over 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why you don't check your portfolio every day.
Yeah. So just a quick point on leaving money in your trading account, technically illegal, but I keep my slush fund there, my emergency fund, because it's a good rate of interest and immediately accessible.
Robin, you will receive those Woolies ETFs for your top 50, and then you should use that money to buy more top 50 if that's the ETF you like. So this is something that took me a little while to maybe not understand. I just don't think I ever really thought about it. And then one day I thought about it, and my head nearly flew off. When you're in a cash product or in a bond product, you limit the amount of money you can make. You can only ever make 8% on an 8% account.
Yeah. Yes.
That's it. Like 8% compounded, that's it. That's what you can make. When you invest in the stock market, there's no upper limit. Sometimes the market goes up 600%.
Mm-hmm.
Not the market, your investment goes up 600%. The market doesn't often go up 600%. But like when you average out the price of your investment, that can go up infinitely for as long as you stay invested.
Yeah.
And so it's not a good idea to cap the amount of money that you can make, which is what you do when you're in a cash or a bond product.
I mean, to just explain, what Christia there means by infinitely. I think Capitec listed at R1, maybe it was R2, now R1,450.50. Just as an example of.
So if you had gotten in on day one, your investment would have increased 1,000-fold.
1,450-fold.
1,450-fold, excuse me.
Yeah, you just robbed me of 450 folds.
And that share did cost you a bottle of bubbles once.
Yeah.
So let me not rob you of that.
It's also made me, so I didn't buy it at one, but I bought it cheap enough.
So Patisile is our diplomat. Do you remember her?
Yeah. Botswana.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she has experience in that. Do you remember when we spoke about minimalism and, you know, how to keep your lifestyle expenses mm-hmm. low and stuff? So she has some experience in the minimalist balancing act, which she thought she'd share with us. I thought it was quite amusing. She says, I was listening to the Keep Your Expenses Low podcast and I laughed because I know I'm a hoarder. I keep things because I think one day I'm going to use them. So I have this pair of jeans that I bought with my first hard-earned money when I worked over school holidays during my A-levels in 2005. So I think that's like matric here.
Yeah, it's also 14 years.
She says, because I had been home for a while at that time, I wore a size 34 jeans. But a couple of months later, I went to varsity and I've been a size 30 to a size 28 since. I kept my near brand new jeans because one day I might need them. And finally, last Christmas, I gave up and I took them home to my mom to give away because clearly I wasn't going to be a size 34 ever again in my life. Except now I'm a size 34.
I was
going to
say, that was it, right? Now you're a 34. Sorry.
I'm laughing at myself. But still, keeping that one pair of jeans would not have made much of a difference.
Yeah.
Look, if you're going broke because of a pair of jeans that you gave away, you've got bigger issues.
But that is, so I was teaching it to my nephew. We were waiting for someone to come to pick us up so we could go swimming. And, you know, they were taking not long, I mean, 10 minutes or something, but he was getting, and I'm like, you want to make them arrive quick, go slice up some pawpaw and eat the pawpaw. And as soon as you start to eat it, they will arrive. And of course it worked. And it just blew his mind. It says it's the law of when you start to do something or you give something away that you haven't needed in 14 years, you will immediately need it or they will immediately arrive.
What is that? All right. Hazel is being stressed by dollar-based investment. She says, I have a dollar investment offshore in some sort of Momentum insurance, like Momentum the company, not Momentum the strategy, insurance or endowment wrapper. I opened it years ago through financial advisors, and at that stage, the whole thing was too daunting for me to do it myself. It has done nothing but lose money for the last 5 years, and it has very high fees. I'm trying to figure out how to move it to a low-cost tracker fund without incurring too many expenses. She wants to keep it offshore. She says, needless to say, they are not going to help me, and I just want to be free of them being Momentum. I'm getting pretty desperate. I do have a UK bank account, if that helps.
So they're not going to let you move it. What they might do is let you make it paid up, and they might also then let you withdraw the money. They will charge you at both of those legs. And when I say charge you, I mean rip you like there's no tomorrow. There's no way of avoiding that. So you can make it paid up. In other words, you stop making contributions. If she says endowment, I'm thinking it's term-based, i.e. it has an expiry date. So you can, if you're still contributing, make it paid up, no more money goes into it. Then if it's term-based, the question is what's the surrender value? Do not work out the math of how much you've been ripped off, because you've been ripped off. The surrender value will be fractions of what you've paid in over the period. But then take the money and run. What they might also then do is insist upon paying the money back into ZAR in South Africa, in which case just transfer it into your UK bank account. They might move it into your UK bank account for you. I doubt it.
This is really interesting.
But there's no way to dodge a lot more fees.
It's interesting because you often speak about, and you did an excellent podcast on your JSE Direct podcast about selling the dogs. Like, what is the, why it's really important when you've made a bad investment to just get rid of it. And it's interesting because I never really put that together with an investment product, but the same principle applies.
You're in a bad product that's costing money and isn't performing. And part of the reason it isn't performing is because A, it's bad, and B, it's undoubtedly layered with more fees than you can imagine. It's stressing you sufficiently that you've written to us and et cetera, et cetera. The best thing is to get rid of it. It will cost you money to get rid of it, but you know what? A good night's sleep is worth a fortune.
If you want to make yourself feel better, maybe you can compare the cost of the product that you're getting out of to the cost of the product that you're going into. and then you can work out how many years it would take you to pay it, to make that money back.
Yeah. And then my advice is when you exit these dogs is don't look at them. But in this case, it's a closed product, so you can't, so it's moot.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is that Hazel probably needs a degree in quantum physics to work out the fee structure.
Yeah.
The absolute, complete, and total honest fee structure.
I have to say, when you guys send me emails with those attachments and you're like, have a look at these fees, I always feel like I just want to, like, why did I not just become like a professional surfer or something, because it's hard, man.
Yeah.
All right. Terrence is starting to lean on his portfolio for living expenses, and he's unsure about what to do about the capital gains tax. He says, if one has bought the same share every year for a number of years, does SARS use the average price to calculate your capital gains tax, or do you have to work it out in the bundles in which you bought them at the bundle price? This seems a very messy and complicated way of doing it, especially if you've been buying the same share every month for the last 20 years.
They use the average.
Yay! This is easy. All right. Hannes, does Terrence need to know anything else about that?
Nope.
Okay.
One thing. If you bought it before 1 October 2001, a long time ago, your capital gains is based on the price on 1 October 2001.
Okay. For everything you had up until then, not for everything since then.
So, for example, I bought Sasol shares in 94 and I think 16 Rand a share. Yet when I sold them for CGT purposes, they will assume I paid 71 Rand 30 because that was the 1 October 2001 price, because that's when CGT came into effect.
Are you telling me that if I had started investing as a kid, I would not have had capital gains tax if I'd gotten out?
Not quite. Well, if you'd
sold before... Because there was no capital gain tax.
There was no capital gain tax before 1 October 2001.
So what did you do? Income tax on that?
No.
You paid no tax when you sold an investment?
Money for jam.
Why do I miss everything? This is so f***ing sad.
This is why this is why the 3Ms gave us tax cuts for every year for 3 or 4 years in a row.
Man, I just, like, every cool thing that has happened, I have missed. Like, it started with Kurt Cobain and it just went on from there. It was just terrible. All right.
So the really tragic part is that 1 October 2001 is that 9/11 happened 3 weeks beforehand. So the markets collapsed, so it dragged all the prices down.
Oh, nice.
No.
No, not higher. Nice, because, yeah, not nice. Because then
you're... But now, truthfully, so the reason I mention it is because Terrence says he's now starting to dip in. So Terrence might actually be old enough where 2001 is a date he remembers and not a date where someone was changing his diapers.
Yeah. All right. Hannes' new job has been getting in the way of his fat wallet listening. Hopefully it's paying him more, so it's worth it.
Oh, I was going to suggest he change jobs.
But he's ready to... Maybe he can become a pilot like Pascal. But he's ready to dive...
A taxi driver.
To dive back in, he says, I find the concept of buy-to-let properties quite attractive. I recently had a discussion with a friend who wants to do exactly that in order to generate some basic passive income in about 5 years. He'll pay off the first small property, then buy a second one, supplementing it with the income from the first, and so on until he gets to a point where the passive income is enough to cover his basic living expenses. What are good ways to generate passive monthly income from investments only? Right now, buy-to-let properties still seem like a pretty good strategy for this. I'd like an apples versus apples comparison between investments and buy-to-let properties for passive income generation.
Sure, the apples to apples is that listed wins.
So, interestingly, the benefit I can see to a buy-to-let property situation versus just straight-up investments is that with a buy-to-let property, because you can use debt, you get to the bigger amounts quicker. Like, because you can take on debt to buy a new property, you get... I know over time it averages out because I can see your face, but
no, but because Magnus did the numbers for us and he assumed you started with 100,000 and the 100,000 you leveraged to 1 million and the other you bought, you didn't, you just bought stuff. And go search Magnus De Wet on Just One Lap and you will find it with spreadsheets and you can play with the spreadsheet. His numbers were quite simple. Over 20 years, you came out about 2% ahead in listed versus unlisted, in other words, buy to let.
But remember that he made a comparison between listed property investments and buy-to-let properties, not listed listed instruments like ordinary shares. Yes,
listed property. And now it's not popping up here. It's on there. There it is. Listed property versus buy to let. And the key point. So the key point was that the listed property won. And I know a bunch of people are going to say, "Oh, but listed properties crashed recently." Yeah, but have you seen what's happening to the home market? The point is that you came out slightly behind, about 2% on average behind, annualized per year, behind if you bought buy to let as opposed to listed. So in order to get to evens, in other words, you're going to match the listed market, you have to be better than average. And in order to beat the listed market, you've got to be a lot better with average. With respect to everybody out there, what makes you the property expert?
So for me, this
and
is...
And I know we all believe we are. Intuitively, we think we can spot a bargain. The truth of the matter is, no.
For me, this is just comes down to effort. Like when you think the amount of effort that it would take your friend to manage the tenants, to do the maintenance, to pay the property taxes, to deal with body corporates, et cetera, versus buying a listed instrument where you literally go onto your brokerage account, you buy it, and then you go away and live your life.
And you wait for the dividends to arrive.
Yeah, maybe I'm just too lazy to have passive income.
The thing is that, and this is a human trait, and it's a very useful human trait, the cognitive bias. If we didn't have it, we would still be in the caves or the trees or the primordial ponds or whatever it is. But we believe that we are special and better than everybody else. And truthfully, we do have areas of expertise, but they're usually the areas of expertise where we have spent a large period of time, like a life worth of time, you know, defining, such as hobbies that we are tentative to, our job sets, our skill sets, etc., etc. And then we look at something else, listed property take as an example, so buy to let, and we're like, I'm an expert, I can spot a bargain. Yeah. No, you can't.
Yeah, so this is often a criticism leveled against professionals like engineers and doctors. I know we don't have any of those listening to this show, who are experts in one thing.
They can build bridges, for goodness sake, or so change hearts.
They're experts in one thing, and because they're expert in one thing, they tend to think they're expert in everything. And that's why so many doctors write us, doctors specifically, because people who sell financial products know that doctors start out on high salaries, specifically write us to say, okay, I got sold a piece of when I was young because I thought I knew everything and I actually didn't.
Yeah. And then in order to beat listed, you've now got to be better than average, which means you've got to be an expert, and you're not. You're just not. Now, there is, you could go and become an expert in property. You absolutely can. I have a friend who's done it and owns 40 plus flats in Pretoria, and he went and became the expert, and he carefully defined the area he wanted and what he wanted and et cetera, et cetera. And he became an expert in changing geezers and breaking kneecaps and all the other important parts of being a landlord. But it took him about a decade.
But you know what? This is very similar to, if you're working in your day job and you're like, I really love the restaurant business, I'm going to open the restaurant business.
Mm.
There's going to be somebody like Taste Holdings is Taste Holdings who own all the restaurant?
Yeah, not very many anymore. Taste is going bankrupt. Use Famous Brands.
Okay, so Famous Brands who own all the restaurants, who do this as an expert, like they're going to do it better than you do it. They're going to find a better location. They're going to find cheaper products to put in, et cetera, et cetera.
They're going to negotiate better leases.
And that's what you're up against. Basically, you're saying, I'm starting a new thing. I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to make it profitable myself from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
Remember also, rental income is taxed as income and not as dividends. And this is true for listed property. It's true for buy-to-let properties, which means that the money that you make before it covers all of your expenses, that money might push you into a higher tax bracket.
So you get to deduct the direct expenses. So if you replace a geezer, that will get deducted. But yes, it can push you up. So it can actually impact much wider than just what you're looking at in that particular issue.
Yeah, so you can actually be worse off from a tax perspective. Yeah. All right. David is a financial planner. He works for a company called Wisdom Asset Management in Pietermaritzburg. And the reason why I mention him is because they charge per hour, which is something that we always say that you should look for, because they don't sell you specific products.
They're not going to take the commission.
So if you are in Pietermaritzburg and you're looking for a financial planner, check out Wisdom Asset Management.
But if you're in Durban, you should go to Pietermaritzburg because they've got all those wonderful little alleyways in the CBD, and one of them is called Exchange Alleyway because there was a stock exchange in Pietermaritzburg, and it was like the third exchange in South Africa. My question was, what the f**k, why? I mean, Kimberley had diamonds, it had an exchange.
The harbour?
No, Pietermaritzburg, 75 k's from the harbour.
Yeah, but you can run there.
Yeah. I can't. So it turned out what happened, because like Barberton had an exchange because of gold, Kimberley diamonds, Joburg gold, Pietermaritzburg. Turned out it was this stockbroker in London who got disbarred because he was a crook. So he went to Pietermaritzburg and set up a stock exchange. Nothing ever happened, but he had one anyway.
Oh, well, good for him. Don't let the bastards grind you down.
So you should go to Pietermaritzburg. It's a fun place.
Anyway, so David smells a rat and discovers negative EAC. He was doing something for a client. He says, so he was doing a calculation for a client for a discovery product. He says, if discovery's effect, if EAC is effective annual cost, so if discovery's EAC over the term of the policy is minus 0.1%, notice the negative sign as per the attached doc, shouldn't we all be investing with them as they are essentially paying us for the privilege of having an RA with them? He says, I've been going through the notes and it states that if a client sticks with their life cover premium and RA premium until retirement, they will receive a bonus which basically reduces their fees to less than nothing. The problem is that Discovery have a stipulation that all RAs must increase the premium by a minimum of CPI plus 3%.
Jeez.
So that's inflation plus 3% if you're under the age of 30 and inflation plus 4.5% if you're over the age of 30. So just to, so
that
inflation
quickly just gets out of control.
So if inflation is 6% and they want you to increase it by inflation plus 4.5%, it means you're going to pay 10.5% every year more on your RA. You know, over 10 years, that's like you pay 100% more than you paid 10 years
ago. So, well, effectively, it means so 4.5 into 72, or was that a hard number? 9 into 72 is 8. So in 16 years, essentially, it's, you're paying in today's money twice what you were because you've that extra 4.5%. So what it means is that if you run this forever, and of course at some point we die, but if we don't die, at some point your RA contribution is more than your monthly income.
So this is exactly David's point. He says, I take it that Discovery realized that most people won't be able to afford this increase in the long term. And remember, this is your RA increase, but you still have to have that life cover with them. He says, if the client...
probably expensive life cover.
If the client makes any changes to their cover or to their RA contributions, they won't receive this magical bonus. They also need to keep their life cover in retirement when they probably don't need it anymore, which is a really good point.
Yeah.
He says, when I come across smoke and mirrors like this, it just makes me so frustrated. I would love to hear your comments and to point out anything that I've overlooked. So I had a look at the attachment that he sent, which gives the fees, the effective annual cost for 1 year, 3 year and 5 year period, and then for a term to retirement, which is 17.67 years. So now you can work out CPI plus 4.5% for 17.67 years, right? So over a 1 year period, get this for the effective annual cost. Are you ready?
9%.
11.5%.
I just picked the biggest number I could possibly imagine.
Over 3 years, 5.42%. Over 5 years, 3.87%. Guys, the reason why we're like in shocked and awe, if you don't know why, is because this amount of money gets deducted from the performance of, no, gets deducted from your portfolio regardless of the performance of that period, which means if you're in that product for a year and your portfolio didn't do anything for a year, which has been true for the market for like 5 years, they will deduct 11.5% of your own money that you have invested, that you have taken the risk on, that you haven't spent
for and giggles.
For jam. And then jam. It's like, all right, 11.5% over 1 year, 5.42% over 3 years, 3.87% over 5 years. That's ridiculous. And then right at the end, minus 0.1%. If you qualify for the bonuses, if you stayed invested, if you contributed CPI plus 4.5%.
So this is the house wins, right? Because some people will get to that 0.1 negative.
Who can afford to increase their retirement contributions by CPI plus 4.5% for 17 years and pay a life insurance premium for 17 years. Nobody's going to get there.
Costa Visa?
He doesn't need a retirement product.
I know, but you asked who, and there's the only name I could think of. Him and Jeff Bezos. So now I'm just looking at the map of where they are in Pietermaritzburg. I lived there. I loved Pietermaritzburg.
We've moved on, Simon.
No, I haven't. I'm still thinking Pietermaritzburg. I used to drive down that little road there just by the race course.
All right. Javier, who was our win of the week 2 weeks ago, or three, 2 weeks ago, is worried about investing both him and his wife's portfolios in the, with the same institutions.
Oh.
He says, my wife and I are opening an RA to contribute up to our 27.5% allowance and a tax-free savings account, which we intend to max out every year. We are pretty set on investing in the lowest cost TFSA and RA providers in the market. What are the risks of both of us using the same providers, not in terms of performance, but in terms of the companies going under? Should we diversify suppliers to avoid counterparty risk, essentially? He says, if a provider defaults, what happens to the investments and the ETFs and the unit trusts that might have been bought throughout the years?
So I'd never thought of this. I mean, it's actually a great idea because, I mean, the odds of, and I'll go into a moment what happens, but the odds of someone defaulting, collapsing and stuff is minute. I mean, it's minute, but it's not zero. I mean, it isn't zero. So what happens in the case of, so if you have a proper JSC registered stockbroker, of which there are very few, then the JSC guarantees your money. And the JSC, so let's even back up, they hold those shares on your behalf. So, you know, if someone is stealing the shares or something like that, there's some fraud happening, the JSC guarantees the money. And last time I checked, because they have results every 6 months, they've got about R1.25 billion to cover that. So, it, you know, and that's probably enough. And these institutions are audited on regularly, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're an FSP, it's then held in a special purpose vehicle, FSP financial services provider as opposed to stockbroker. And to you as a client, you don't see the distinction at all. They then have insurance to then protect them because they don't get JSC protection. And again, that's probably enough. But there is a risk, right? But then one of you, so the point is that you've found the best, cheapest place to be and you're there. Now, one of you has to leave and go to a more expensive place. That cost, I mean, is essentially you're paying an insurance policy. It's an insurance policy.
But, I mean, now there are providers that offer very similar costs. For example, if you go 10X Insignia for your RA products and you do one-on-one, you know, you'll come out basically the same or slightly cheaper on the one than the other one, probably, depending on what you choose. So it might be worthwhile shopping around. I don't think it's a terrible idea.
I don't think it's a terrible idea. I mean, I think the odds of it happening, I mean,
But also remember, like, if you hold an ETF through an FSP, that still is your ETF. It's not like you're never going to get it back.
Well, no, if it's just stolen out from under you. So let's say I'm a stockbroker and you buy ETFs via me, and one day I sell all the ETFs in the account, take the money and go and buy bubbles and drink it all by morning, and you wake up in the morning and there's nothing left in the account, and I drank the bubbles. I mean, I'm going to jail, but there's no money.
Well, you might be dead from alcohol poisoning.
Yeah. So, yes, I mean, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't think it's terrible. I mean, it's a little paranoid, but a little paranoid is not always... I mean, put it the other way around. We're going to look really stupid if someone goes down and, like, you know...
Yeah. It's worth looking into.
Yeah.
Let us know what you guys decide. I don't think you're being ludicrous.
No.
Okay.
A little, you know, we're safe there just because... Do you think they're after you doesn't mean... No, what's it?
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not...
After you, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Ramaloy, or Khamaloy, I'm never sure, is ready for his first property. He says, I currently stay with my parents, but I have been property hunting for a while now. I've set myself a savings target for various things, including a comfortable emergency fund, a fund for household items, as well as helping my mom wherever I can. I've been disciplined enough to contribute to this target. I haven't met it yet because the time I have set to achieve the goal hasn't elapsed yet. Okay. I recently found a property that appears to check a lot of the right boxes. I'm yet to view the property, but I've driven around the area once and I plan on taking a few more drives around there. I've done Google map searches as well as checking the kind of internet they have in the area. They have fiber, which is a huge plus. It's so funny how that's like a requirement for all of us.
No, hey, fair.
He says, while I'm willing and ready, I haven't gotten my money right yet. I know exactly when my money will be right, but I worry that the property will be gone by then. Is there a way I can buy the property now and start paying and moving in at a later date of my choosing? I'm aware that buying property is not an overnight thing. A friend told me that his purchase took 3 months to finalize. Man, that's quick. What are the costs and possible penalties I could face from trying to do this sort of thing? And is there any reason why this might be a bad idea?
So, look, my short answer is to wait.
So is mine.
I know, it's a horrible answer, and that's not the answer they wanted to hear. Just a quick aside, I also check traffic, and you can do that just by logging on to Waze or Google Maps.
In peak hours.
Yeah. Because traffic is both time, but also noise and pollution. So the process takes 3-4 sometimes 6 or 7 months to go through if there's higgles or something. But you need to pay the deposit immediately upon signing, and you need to lodge with the lawyer, transfer costs, taxes, and all of that sort of stuff.
And you know that comfy emergency fund you've been building? That's gone after all of that.
So lawyer bond registration's about 5 or 10 grand, lawyers about 15 or 20, and then first 900,000 you don't pay, and thereafter you pay a transfer tax. Google will tell you how much. But there are risks. I mean, the risk is that you start down this road, you can't afford it, and you default, and the first person who will see you is the estate agent for their commission. Even if they then sell the house to somebody else, they will sue you for their commission because they didn't get it and they want it, and the lawyer will charge you for their time. I mean, it just gets, you don't want to take that risk, because maybe you're like, well, if it takes 6 months, I'm golden. But what happens if you've got a super speedy lawyer and it takes two and you're not golden?
Yeah, so you know what you need to be ready, because the risk can be something different. Like, the risk can be maybe you can afford the property and you're fine and everything, and once you're in, like what happened in my place, there's a huge issue with the property and you need to fund that out of pocket. It might not bankrupt you, but it might set you back in your financial targets for a long time. However, I do want to say that at the moment we are in what is called a buyer's market as opposed to a seller's market. It means that places tend to stay on the market for a long, long time, and they typically don't sell at asking price. So what you could do, depending on how much time you have or how much time you need to reach those financial goals, is to engage the agent and make the agent very aware that you are interested in the property, and then keep tabs on the property and have the agents tell you if somebody else makes an offer on the property. Because that buys you some time, at least. Yeah. It doesn't. It's not a perfect solution, because the agent could lie, or it could go, or whatever.
Estate agents are, except for the one who's saying that they're not. Every other estate agent is.
Oh, it's just terrible people.
And I know you're different, but not everyone else. So I'm wondering if they legally can. So I know that they can't legally tell you what the other offer is, but I see no reason why they couldn't tell you that there is another offer. But I also know what happens, right? So the estate agent has sold the place. Now you want them to go and tell somebody else. No, because they want that person to buy something else so they can sell two places.
But you know what you can also do, because this is what you did, Simon, is just because somebody made an offer on a place doesn't mean you can't make an offer. So once a property is under offer, the estate agent is obligated by law to take the offer to the seller. Even when it's under offer, because remember,
even though the estate agent, so I mean, yes, but so that's how we got our place. There was an offer. I don't know what it was for, but I know it was for 100% bond. So I made a cheeky offer at 100% cash, and the initial offerer had 24 hours to match it and couldn't. And then the seller said, no, I'm going to take, because there was a risk that the first purchaser couldn't get the bond and it all fell through.
Yeah.
But there's another example. When I first moved to Joburg, there's
But remember also that this could happen to you if you're the one applying for the bond. Yeah, yeah. Somebody else can do this to you as well.
But when I moved to Joburg and there was a place we wanted to buy and I phoned up the guy and we saw it and everything, and then he just went quiet to me and I phoned him. I said, I want to, you know, I'm interested. And he says, I got an offer. I said, cool, I'll make a counter offer. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll get back to you. Still waiting.
So what you can
because the agent's got the sale. He doesn't now want someone else coming and f***ing up his sale. He wants me to buy a different house, so he's got two sales.
So what you can do is you can ask the agent to see the place. Then go see the place and not say anything. And just wait. And then when the agent gets back to you and says, do you want to buy the place? You say, actually, I need to see it again. And then you go and see it again and you wait. And you wait and you wait and you try and just push it out for as long as possible, because properties aren't moving very fast at the moment. You could possibly kick this can down the road if you are a little bit devious and you try a little bit.
Yeah.
If you are not keen on doing that, if that doesn't happen, I know that having gone through this process myself very recently, you find a place and you're like, this is the perfect place. I'll never find anything as good again. But, yeah, but you do. Yeah. You do. You find places that are better price, you find places that are more suited to your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Don't be in a rush. I mean, this is a huge decision.
There have been three properties that I tried to buy and failed, and each time it was basically the agents just cut me out because they had somebody else. And like the one I actually wanted to make a counter offer, and they lied to me and said, no, you can't. And that's just not true. But the point being is that in each one of those three times, it was tragic. It was heartbreaking. And this was the property. Without this, I can't even remember what one of them was. Or what city it was.
All right. That is it from the Just One Lap team this week. I just wanted to say, on the 5th of December, we've got our year-end thing at the JSE.
Oh, yeah.
That's always our most fun event for the year, for me at least, because A, I'm not speaking, so I can just sit there and enjoy it. But I always love those position your portfolio discussions, because you mark yourself and it's funny. So you guys should join us for that at the JSE on the 12th of December. It's going to be a super fun event. That's it from the Just One Lap team this week. Remember, this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for being our community wizards. My name is Christy Afanyedin. Thank you to Simon Brown. We'll catch you next week.